Hi, everyone. My name's Terry Hutchinson. Welcome to the Interpreter Insights Podcast. The discussion topic for this podcast is a survey of the Interpreter Journal, especially the early volumes. I don't have a co-host for this episode, which is very unusual for me. Before we begin, the mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, and scripture roundtables. We invite you to see what the Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. Now, if you like this podcast, please tell your friends about it and subscribe. You can subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts. Because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make here are solely our responsibility. Now, the discussion topic, as I mentioned, is a survey of the first four volumes of the Interpreter Foundation Journal. The Interpreter originally was founded in 2012. They were just going to release a few articles that they had in stock, in inventory, and they were going to release one every week online, and it was going to be free. Well, we are now more than 750 articles later. The Interpreter Journal is currently divided into 68 volumes. And so every few months, I want to talk about a few of the volumes of the past and bring those to light so that you might go back and remember some of those. And maybe, especially if you haven't been following Interpreter for the last 13 years, 14 years, I should say, then you'll be interested to see what we have done in the past. We're going to talk about the contents. We're going to talk about what I thought. Feel free to add your comments to this podcast on the website, and I will respond. And if you have particular articles or feelings about the articles that we go through in this podcast, I'm happy to respond. Now, Volume 1, as I mentioned, came out in 2012, and it consists of 10 articles. Daniel Peterson, of course, was the editor. He's the founder of the Interpreter Foundation. The Interpreter Foundation has branched out into a lot of other areas. And as we continue with this series, which, like I said, is going to happen every couple of months, every few months, because I really like having guests on to discuss important scholarship about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and its doctrines, and especially about the Scriptures, we're going to get some other insights about some of the background on these articles and what is available for you. If you want to know how to find these articles, you can go to the Interpreter Foundation website, look up the journal, and then go into the indexes and just call up the journal indexes. Now, there's indexes for topics, there's indexes for authors, there's indexes for dates, and the journal volumes are presented in order from newest to oldest, but there is a menu where you can just click on it and it will say oldest to newest. And that's the one that we look at in terms of doing this survey. Every volume has an introduction by one of the editors. Nearly all of the 68, with a few exceptions, are provided by Daniel Peterson, who's the president and founder of the foundation and who's currently involved in the Becoming Brigham series that's being put out every Monday on YouTube and various other channels. And we had Daniel on our initial podcast to talk about that, to talk about the Interpreter Foundation and what his goals originally were for the journal. Volume 1 came out in 2012, and there are 10 articles in it. The first is called Charity in Defending the Kingdom. It's written by Dan Peterson, and some of it was written after he moved from the Maxwell Institute to the Interpreter Foundation. In fact, the Interpreter Foundation was formed as a result of Dan's leaving the Maxwell Institute when the Institute changed its emphasis from apologetic and more faithful research to become more of an academic emphasis, something which hasn't really led well to its popularity among most of the Latter-day Saints, and especially among those who contribute. Now, one of the articles that was a big interest to me was the first one that came out. It's by David E. Bokovoy. That article is called Thou Knowest That I Believe, Invoking the Spirit of the Lord as Counsel Witness in 1 Nephi 11. Here is the abstract of that article. The Book of Mormon features an esoteric exchange between the prophet Nephi and the Spirit of the Lord on an exceedingly high mountain. The following essay explores some of the ways in which an Israelite familiar with ancient religious experiences and scribal techniques might have interpreted this event. The analysis shows that Nephi's conversation, as well as other similar accounts in the Book of Mormon, echoes an ancient temple motif. As part of this paradigm, the essay explores the manner in which the text depicts the Spirit of the Lord in a role associated with members of the Divine Council in both biblical and general Near Eastern conceptions. When I saw this article, I knew that the Interpreter Journal was something I wanted to subscribe to and look forward to its releases every week, and I have not been disappointed. There's also a feature about replies, which allows for comments from readers and interaction occasionally even with the authors of those articles, and those are worth looking at as well. The second article is The Cultural Context of Nephite Apostasy. Then there is a book review of Temple Themes in the Book of Moses by Jeffrey M. Bradshaw, reviewed by George L. Minton. Another one that was very interesting to me was I Have Revealed Your Name, The Hidden Temple in John 17 by William J. Hamlin. In the abstract, the late Bill Hamlin writes, John 17 contains a richly symbolic last discourse by Jesus in which the disciples are assured a place in the Father's celestial house or temple. To fulfill this promise, Christ reveals both the Father's name and his glory to his disciples. Jesus' discourse concludes with the promise of sanctification of the disciples and their unification or deification with Christ and the Father. This paper explores how each of these ideas reflects the temple theology of the Bible and contemporary first century Judaism. Now, the next article is an open letter to Dr. Michael Coe by John Sorensen. Michael Coe is famous for arguing that the Book of Mormon is not legitimate because there's no archaeological evidence found for it in Mesoamerica. John Sorensen responds to that. The next article is Atheist Piety, A Religion of Dogmatic Dubiety by Lou Midgley. Then there's a book review, Latter-day Saint Scripture, Studies in the Book of Mormon by Robert M. Price by Lou Midgley. Mormonism and Wikipedia, The Church History That Anyone Can Edit by Roger Nicholson. And finally, rounding up this volume 195 pages later is To Really Read the Book of Mormon by Ralph C. Hancock. The second and final volume, released in 2012, was headed by an introduction by Dan Peterson called The Role of Apologetics in Mormon Studies. And this is back in the days before President Nelson gave us the counsel about the name of the church. So a lot of it is reflected by the time that it was written. So keep that in mind as you look at these. The next article is Attacking Rather Than Explaining. And then an important one that caught my eye, Evaluating Three Arguments Against Joseph Smith's First Vision by Stephen C. Harper. Stephen, in my opinion, is one of the experts on the First Vision, as well as early church history. He just recently finished a stint as the editor of BYU Studies, where he did a fantastic job. The abstract of this article is as follows. Historically, there have been just three basic arguments against the authenticity of Joseph Smith's First Vision. They all begin with the a priori premise that such a vision simply could not have happened. The arguments originated with the Methodist minister to whom Joseph related his vision, author Fawn Brodie and the Reverend Wesley Walters. The minister's critique is explained by Methodism's shift away from ecstatic religious experience. Fawn Brodie is shown to have made innovative yet flawed arguments within the narrow scope allowed by her conclusion that Joseph was a charlatan, a conclusion that did not allow for alternative interpretations of new evidence. Walters is shown to make fallacious arguments of irrelevant proof and negative proof in his understandably determined effort to undermine Joseph Smith's credibility. Close-minded believers in Joseph Smith's vision are similarly likely to make unfounded assumptions unless they become open to the rich historical record Joseph created. Belief in the vision should correspond to Christian empathy for and civility towards critics. Following Harper's article, there is a book review, Christian Faith in Contemporary China by Lou Midgley, and then a very long article revisiting the forgotten voices of weeping in Moses 7, a comparison with ancient texts, written by Jeffrey M. Bradshaw, Jacob A. Reniger, and David J. Larson. Then there's Variants in the Stories of the First Vision of Joseph Smith and the Apostle Paul by John A. Tvetnes. He passed away, unfortunately, when I first started getting involved with Interpreter, and it's fortunate that we still have a lot of his work in print, especially here, free and available to all and easy to find. Then there is Rethinking the Apostle Peter's Role in the Early Church by Noel B. Reynolds. Then there is Why Was 1/6 of the 1830 Book of Mormon Set from the Original Manuscript by Royal Skousen. Royal Skousen is another one who's done some terrific original work formulating a critical edition of the text of the Book of Mormon from the printers and original manuscripts. And he's done a lot of work for the Joseph Smith Papers, and the rest of it has been sponsored first of all by Farms, then the Maxwell Institute, and finally wrapped up by being supported by the Interpreter Foundation. Then there's a book review, Shaken Faith Syndrome and the Case for Faith by Stephen O. Smoot. And remember, this is back in 2012 when some of these problems were first beginning to affect members of the church and especially their children and grandchildren by them running across stories of the history in the internet and in other places that were designed to immediately raise distrust in the prophet Joseph Smith and in the restored gospel, among other things. And this was an article and a book review about how to deal with that by Stephen Smoot, who's also been with us on Interpreter and will be again. Then Defending the King and His Kingdom by Lou Midgley. And finally, my favorite in this collection was The Apocryphal Acts of Jesus by John Gee. Now, those of you who've listened to the podcast realize I've had John on the program. John and I co-hosted the Interpreter Foundation radio program for several years together. John and I are family friends. Our parents go way back, and we've known each other since we were children. And I really admire his work, but this was one that I really appreciated. Let me read you the abstract. Numerous non-canonical accounts of Jesus' deeds exist. While some Latter-day Saints would like to find plain and precious things in the apocryphal accounts, few are to be found. Three types of accounts deal with Jesus as a child, his mortal ministry, or after his resurrection. The Jesus of the infancy Gospels does not act like the Jesus of the real Gospels. The apocryphal accounts of Jesus' ministry usually push a particular theological agenda. The accounts of Jesus' post-resurrection teaching often contain intriguing but bizarre information. On the whole, apocryphal accounts of Jesus' ministry probably contain less useful information for Latter-day Saints than I might expect. And right before the beginning of the notes, John talks about a history of this article. This article has a history. It was originally commissioned in the early 1990s as general overview and a companion piece to an article by Stephen Robinson on the apocryphal words of Jesus for a volume to be published by Brigham Young University's Religious Studies Center. That volume was canceled after it was deemed too technical. John W. Welch then requested it to be submitted to BYU Studies. The editors, however, rejected this article because it took too dim a view of apocryphal literature. In 2011, Christian Heal requested the author to submit it to studies in the Bible and Antiquity, but the editors rejected it on the grounds that it was a general overview. It has not been substantially updated. And that wraps up 2012's second volume. 2013, the second year of the Interpreter Foundation's existence, saw five volumes added to the journal collection, but we're only going to survey two more. The first one was Volume 3. There are 10 articles, and the first, of course, is an introduction by Dan Peterson, reflecting on gospel scholarship with Abdul Al-Walid and Abu Hamid. Then there's a book review, Comparing and Evaluating the Scriptures, a Timely Challenge for Jews, Christians, Muslims, and Mormons, by Cassandra S. Hedelius. Then there's another by the late John Tvetnes, Biblical and Non-Biblical Quotes in the Sermons and Epistles of Paul. Then Evangelical Controversy, a Deeply Fragmented Movement by Lou Midgley. A Book of Mormon article, In His Footsteps, Ammon the First and Ammon the Second by Val Larson. Then another book review, Forgery and Counterforgery, The Use of Literary Deceit in Early Christian Polemics by Bart D. Ehrman by Robert Boylan. From the East to the West, The Problem of Directions in the Book of Mormon by Brant Gardner. Brant is the author of Second Witness, which is a six-volume commentary on the Book of Mormon that's absolutely terrific. You can get it electronically. It's a little hard to find in hardback, but you can find it. Published by Coford Books, Brandt's also written several other books about the Book of Mormon, and he's done some terrific work, as we'll see in later surveys of this journal. The 1985 publication of John L. Sorensen's An Ancient American Setting for the Book of Mormon presented the best argument for a New World location for the Book of Mormon. For all of its strengths, however, one aspect of the model has remained perplexing. It appeared that in order to accept that correlation, one must accept that the Nephites rotated north to what we typically understand as northwest. The internal connections between text and geography were tighter than any previous correlation, and the connections between that particular geography and the history of the peoples who lived in that place during Book of Mormon times was also impressive. There was just that little problem of north not being north. This paper re-examines the Book of Mormon directional terms and interprets them against the cultural system that was prevalent in the area defined by Sorensen's geographical correlation. The result is a way to understand Book of Mormon directions without requiring any skewing of magnetic north. Now, I've never been super interested in following the arguments about Book of Mormon geography. I tend to lean towards the Mesoamerican theory, but I'm not one to live and die on whether that theory is right or not. For me, the article that interested me most in this volume came from A. Keith Thompson, who's a member of the church in Australia, and he's put together a book collecting most of his interpreter articles, but you can get them right here in the journal for free. The book is really hard to find, and it's a bit expensive. The first is called Nephite Insights into Israelite Worship Practices Before the Babylonian Captivity. The abstract of that article is: general historical consensus holds that synagogues originated before the destruction of the Second Temple in AD 70, and therefore probably originated during the Babylonian captivity. The suggestion in Philo and Josephus that synagogues may have originated during the Exodus was discredited by some historians in the 17th century. Yet the Book of Mormon speaks of synagogues, sanctuaries, and places of worship in a manner which suggests that Lehi and his party brought some form of synagogal worship with them when they left Jerusalem around 600 BC. This essay revisits the most up-to-date scholarship regarding the origin of the synagogue and suggests that the Book of Mormon record provides ample reason to look for the origins of the synagogue much earlier than has become the academic custom. I really like Brother Thompson's work, and I encourage you to look for it anywhere you can find it, because he's got several articles that have been published in the Interpreter. We will be covering them all in later surveys. Then, New Light and Old Shadows, John G. Turner's Attempt to Understand Brigham Young by Craig Foster. And this is a substantial review of John Turner's book on Brigham Young that was published by Harvard. John Turner, just last year, published a biography of Joseph Smith by Yale. And finally, the last article here is one that brought a lot of replies. It's called One Day to a Cubit by Hollis Johnson. The abstract: an investigation of ancient astronomy shows that a cubit was used not only as the metric of length, elbow to fingertip, but also as a metric of angle in the sky. That suggested a new interpretation that fits naturally. The brightest celestial object, the sun, moves eastward around the sky relative to the stars during the course of a year by one cubit per day. This is the first introduction of ancient astronomy into the Interpreter Foundation Journal. There are others. Only in the Foundation Journal can you find these. Finally, we're going to end our survey with the second 2013 volume, Volume 4. Begins with a preface by Dan Peterson, Standing on the Shoulders of Giants, followed by 74 pages by Jeffrey M. Bradshaw and David J. Larson called Ancient Affinities Within the LDS Book of Enoch, Part 1 and Part 2. Now, these articles were expanded into In God's Likeness and Image, written by Jeff and David, which was published by the Interpreter Foundation. It was the first book published by the Interpreter Foundation in conjunction with Eborn Books. There have been several others. I highly recommend all of them. But this was an article that I just really enjoyed. Then, Trusting Joseph by Neil Rapley, which is a book review of Samuel Alonzo Dodge and Stephen Harper Exploring the First Vision, which is a series of scholarly articles about the First Vision. Then Confronting Five-Point Calvinism by Lou Midgley. And a real interesting article, Whither Mormon Studies by John Gee, which is about a 37-page article talking all about Mormon studies and some of the strengths and weaknesses of those who claim to practice it, and how some of them don't really know what it is to study Mormon studies. And John has always been a scholar of those who study the church, and he does his own work, and he's very honest about what he finds. And this was an article that gathered 42 replies, some in agreement, some not in agreement. That article was followed by Letter to a Doubter by Terrell Givens. This is something where he wrote to people about their doubts, and it spawned 68 replies. Just reading the replies and the authors back and forth is something that is worthwhile. One that I found very interesting was by the late Bill Hamlin, The Sud of Yahweh and the Endowment. In the Hebrew Bible, the Sud of God was a council of celestial beings who consulted with God, learned his Sud, or secret plan, and then fulfilled that plan. This paper argues that the LDS Endowment is, in part, a ritual reenactment of the Sud, where the participants observed the Sud council of God, learned the Sud secret plan of God, and covenant to fulfill that plan. This was a very short article, but the bibliography is incredibly valuable. I'm the kind of person who reads footnotes and bibliographies extensively, and in fact, I've developed the habit of reading the bibliography and the footnotes before I read the text. That article is followed by an article by Stephen D. Ricks called Some Notes on Book of Mormon Names. Some of this was later put into the Book of Mormon Onomasticon Project, and it was eventually compiled into a volume published by the Interpreter Foundation. And finally, the last three articles are about Josiah's Reform and Introduction. And this is another thing that I really enjoy about the Interpreter Foundation. There is not a uniform way to look at certain issues. So there's a beginning introduction, just a couple of pages, by Benjamin McGuire about Josiah's reform and some of the differences. And then there's an article called Vindicating Josiah by Bill Hamlin. In that article, the abstract says, Margaret Barker has written a number of fascinating books on ancient Israelite and Christian temple theology. One of her main arguments is that the temple reforms of Josiah corrupted the pristine original Israelite temple theology. Josiah's reforms were therefore, in some sense, an apostasy. According to Barker, early Christianity is based on the pristine, original, pre-Josiah form of temple theology. This paper argues that Josiah's reforms were a necessary correction to contemporary corruption of the Israelite temple, rituals, and theologies, and that the type of temple apostasy Barker describes is more likely associated with Hasmoneans. Now, I'm a big fan of Margaret Barker's work, but I do see where Brother Hamblin is coming from. But the fact that someone in the Interpreter Foundation was setting out in a scholarly way to criticize Margaret Barker's theories was new to me. And to their credit, that was immediately followed by an article by my friend and former co-host Kevin Christensen called Prophets and Kings in Lehi's Jerusalem and Margaret Barker's Temple Theology, which is a counterpoint to Brother Hamlin's article. In the abstract, King Josiah's reign has come under increasing focus for its importance to the formation of the Hebrew Bible, and for its proximity to the ministry of important prophets such as Jeremiah and Lehi. Whereas the canonical accounts and conventional scholarship have seen Josiah portrayed as the ideal king, Margaret Barker argues Josiah's reform was hostile to the temple. This essay offers a counterpoint to Professor Hamlin's Vindicating Josiah essay, offering arguments that the Book of Mormon and Barker's views and sources support one another. I really appreciated the fact that the scholars could present arguments for more than one side of a situation, and then let the reader decide. Dive into the footnotes. Evaluate the evidence for yourselves. That wraps up our survey for this episode of the podcast, and as I said, we'll do it again in a couple of months with another several volumes as we continue to talk about the history of the Interpreter, but also reintroduce some of the classic and important scholarship that has been made available through the efforts of the volunteers of the Interpreter Foundation. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast. Join myself or Martin Tanner for future episodes. This is Terry Hutchinson. Thank you for listening.